Welcome to the Amazon Legends Podcast, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became powerful sellers, also experts specializing in helping sellers, and both former and current Amazon employees who will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here's your host, Nick Urison.
Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. My next guest today spent over a decade in e-commerce, growing brands on Amazon and Walmart. He is the CEO and co-founder of Bellavix. Bellavix is an Amazon marketing agency, and they work with private label sellers, and they are certified through the Amazon Service Provider Network, which means that these guys go by the book. They don't break rules. They don't recommend breaking rules. They know exactly what they are and how to implement. So outside of work, he's a proud dad and loves watching football. That's American football. We had that conversation a little earlier. We're recording this in November 2022, and there's a World Cup going on for the real football. So he's into American football, and especially with his kids. So with that, everybody, meet my guest, Will Hare. Welcome to the show, Will.
Hey, Nick. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. And the debate wasn't on which was real football, but how the games were going. So very exciting time. Either football you guys pledged to.
Yes. So, when we met, as we record this in November 2022, there is a new service that Amazon launched. So you mentioned that, which frankly I didn't know about, because there's the shopping season is just about to start. A lot of new things get rolled out. So tell us about this new service Amazon rolled out.
The new service, the advertising service or the warehouse direct service?
Warehouse.
Yeah, so they essentially they're scaling. Like if you're following news, and they recently released their FBA fee increases that are happening January 17th. So we're losing the fuel and surcharge and all that other fun stuff. What they're tightening their warehouse through FBA that other sellers have the ability to sell through. So if your inventory is not moving, it's already started and it's going to continue starting, as you're going to pay more fees. And it's going to be more expensive to move products on Amazon. However, Amazon is a large business who has a lot of warehouse spaces. So they have this AWD, I think it's Amazon Warehousing and Distribution, I think is the exact, it's pretty new. But essentially, Amazon will handle the fulfillment on your behalf. They'll act essentially as your third-party warehousing facility. They will ship products in unmarked Amazon boxes to end customers. If you wanted to fulfill orders from your website, Walmart, or other brick and mortar retailers, where you can have a fulfilled by merchant type relationship. So it's a great new program. It comes with some of its expenses. Is probably, you could definitely find more cost effective options, but some of the benefits is that, tapped into Amazon's ecosystem. You could hold more inventory through that program. And then just the ability to have the 2-day shipping from, your website and really anywhere else, not to mention, it's not available overseas, but what Amazon as a platform can bring you opportunity when it comes to global expansion. So a little bit about the program and a little bit about the history and how we're getting here. I think what we're seeing a pivot on is Amazon shifting out of the warehousing space through their FBA and third-party logistics company, whether through Amazon or through third-party channels, are going to be fulfilling a lot of Amazon orders in the future.
So, okay, so this is, let's scrutinize this program a little bit to figure out the best use of it, because this is, how it is. There's all these tools that come out, and the question is not about the tool, but what is the best use of it? How does it apply to me? So that's what I want to be able to deliver for anybody listening. So the standard model that I recommend for anybody starting on Amazon is send your inventory to Amazon and let Amazon do the fulfillment, which is called Fulfillment by Amazon. That's going to give you the Prime badge, and then it's going to isolate you from having to deal with pick pack ship operations. But most important, it will be fully scalable. So if you suddenly receive 1,000 orders, it's no problem. Amazon will, provided you have inventory, Amazon will fulfill them. Good luck doing that yourself, you know, or paying somebody. The second thing is your costs per shipment are fixed. So, you know, whether it's going to New York or California or Seattle or Miami, it's the same thing per SKU basis. So this is called FBA. However, as you put it, Amazon is tightening up on FBA limits where you can no longer send, you know, as many pieces as you want per SKU, because they don't want to be a warehouse. I should say the fulfillment service does not want to be a warehouse. They want to be just fulfilling orders, and they want high turnover on your inventory. So you want to, it's up to the seller to make sure that you know you are carrying enough inventory to service your order flow. And if your order flow goes down, you need to take it back, vice versa. So this is FBA. Now, some sellers use 3PL companies where they get the container shipped directly from China to their 3PL, because they can't, Amazon won't take the entire container if there is not history. Then they ship it to 3PL. Then it's up to the 3PL to break up according to the seller's instructions and send smaller shipments to Amazon. So my understanding is Amazon Warehouse Delivery Service, or AWD, replaces the need to use 3PL. You can have it shipped to Amazon. So is that what I'm supposed to understand?
That's exactly it. So that is an end-to-end service where you hit it on the head where, and you know, and it does make sense. You brought up a really interesting point. If you are a startup seller, if you're new to market, you know, FBA is going to be the way to go. They'll limit your inventory, but you'll have enough to at least get started and validate your product. But, you know, if you're shipping in a lot of product, if you see a lot of sales, we have a novelty seller. He sells novelty items that we work with. And Q4 is a really good season for him. He makes 80% of his cash. Where the traditional FBA algorithm fell short is it looks at, let's just say, a 90-day average. It's an algorithm. I don't know exactly how it looks, but it showed slow sales. So as we're ramping into the season, we just keep hitting these inventory restrictions and we can't keep in enough stocks. And it's not cost effective for us to roll in small quantities on a weekly or even multiple times a week basis. So a solution and what we're pushing him towards next year is that AWD, just when you get, it's all made overseas. When you get it made, just ship it over, have Amazon just check it all in. The process is streamlined and you're not adding in additional components that could cause damage or lost inventory or, you know, all the headaches that happen dealing with the third party logistics company. Not to say that Amazon doesn't have its own headaches for anybody who works in the system, but it's right for the right type of business. And the novelty company is an example where we would say, you know, let's roll with this because it's going to eliminate a lot of this warehouse and operational work that isn't tied directly to sales, but it is tied to its bottom line.
Okay. So that means that AWD will sit alongside FBA and you will simply replenish from AWD location to FBA location. So but this is still just like using your own warehouse where you have to give instructions. In other words, like if you receive an order, Amazon will not ask you, should they fulfill the order? If you have the FBA inventory, they'll fill it right away. So is there such streamlined operation where they are pulling from AWD, or you still have to instruct AWD to ship so much to replenish the FBA inventory?
Still have to communicate with AWD. It is a warehousing and it's different, to your point, from the fulfillment center. So there will be communications, there'll be shipments that track. It is smoother because it's all integrated into the one system, but you have to tell them where to put your inventory. Yeah. There are instances where maybe you have retail obligations and it's important that that inventory be reserved for Macy's for Black Friday or something like that, where you wouldn't want to tap into that and you wouldn't want the system just to take that product out. So those are some reasons why you have to kind of go through their process.
Okay. So there is one more thing that I caught you mention. It's fulfilling website orders. So Amazon has this as an FBA inventory. You can tap into your FBA inventory also to fulfill your website orders mm-hmm. that Amazon calls multi-channel fulfillment or
there you
MCF.
Go.
There are different rates for it. So this has been in existence for a while.
Yeah.
So what you mentioned that is provided under Amazon Warehouse and Delivery Service or AWD service, is that in addition to that, or is it replacing it, or what is the relationship?
In addition to it, and it's just pulling inventory from different pots. So they're separated. You could still set up MCF and not need to be doing AWD. So it'll exist, but it's your ability, like I said, to dictate where you're making orders and where you're pushing inventory through. So you have the ability on both platforms.
Okay. I tell you, it's soon Amazon, running an Amazon operation will be the alphabet.
Yeah, it's very true.
Yeah, it's all coded. I mean, these guys already speak a different language. You know, you have to decode the language. So I had a couple of Amazonians on the show and I say, you know, you guys, do you like go through a different training about the language? Because, you know, it's now in addition to figuring out what they really said, you also have these acronyms all the time.
I'd say acronyms for everything. At first, it drove me crazy. Now it's second nature. I had an interview with a media person recently, and I could tell she understood Amazon because she was asking me questions and she was using like ASIN. And language like that, where I'm like, okay, you're savvy. You understand some of the acronyms.
Yeah. It's well, I mean, it's a mouthful otherwise, right? So it's,
mm-hmm.
And also, you know, I think this is important for really on a philosophical level. When you create an operation, I think it's important to give it an identity because yeah. that identity will govern the operation. So people start to take ownership of it and then they coin phrases and then suddenly you create positions for it. And so it takes a life form of its own. So I think it's a good practice.
It's so true. And like the great companies, Amazon does it, but Google has done it. Facebook has done it. And that's how you get these like prolific iterations and already great, great existing software. So I think that's well yeah. said, Nick.
Thank you. So so I have another question for you. So we you know, as I mentioned, we're recording this in November 2022. In fact, today is Tuesday, and in 2 days we'll have the start to the shopping season.
Yeah.
Thanksgiving. So we have no idea how it's going to play out, but nevertheless, undeniably the conditions are much tougher than last year. We have high inflation, we have shrinking margins. So tell us, how do you drive growth to your clients?
Yeah, so I think it's really interesting you mentioned that too. I was reading an article on Marketplace Pulse on the trajectory for e-commerce. It's going to be this year, it's on its way to being a $1 trillion market, where pre-pandemic, it was forecasted to be about $800 billion and 10% of total retail. And right now it's trending at around 15%. So that being said, people are going through a recession. There's less disposable income, but people are shopping. People are doing their holiday shopping. We're technically, you know, 5% more online shoppers and 5% in general, based on what we assume growth, is just more market to go after. It is settling it out. So what's really exciting is like, this is kind of the new norm where a lot of these brick and mortar retailers are opening their doors and they're having Black Friday start on November 1st. So Halloween, you get your one day and then bam, it's shopping season. We're talking Christmas. And that'll go through, you know, all the way through December. And what's really interesting is that these retailers are giving their employees and people back Thanksgiving. So my wife and I were talking about gone are the days like Thursday at 5 o'clock. Our nephews or nieces have to leave because they have to go man the retail stores. So there's a lot of change going on culturally and behaviorally. So how do we get our brands ready? Obviously, it starts with good listings, updating them to making sure you have very giftable imagery, the language you're using, if it is a giftable item. My favorite example is like if you sell plungers, that's a great gift for your mother-in-law, but not a really a great gift for anybody else. So stick to the function of the products. No need to put a bow on that. That's definitely something you buy when you need. But if you sell beauty products or anything like that, it pays to have these lifestyle images and to get some language in there, gifts for her, whether it's on the front end or the back end. And then to incorporate that into the bullets and the A+ content. So obviously you want to do your most stellar products and you want to make sure that you have the most optimal content that's going to improve and lift your conversion rate. And then from there, it's just the marketing and advertising aspect. So it's like, how do you build audiences based on our efficiency standard? We like to use TACOS, total advertising cost of sale. So like, how do we build your audience? How do we get somebody in market? And how do we get people who don't even know about your brand to come make a commitment and make a purchase? And that's that is a culmination of having the right search engine optimization on the listing through listing attributes for a relevancy of the keywords on the actual listing, sales history for what it actually sells for, but then also some of those visual, what's the conversion rate, and then the advertising, how are we pushing our products in front of people who are searching for our brand or for in market for our actual product, as well as how do we get people who are in the aisle or looking complimentary. And then what's an acceptable cost at the end of the day? You know, how much is it worth acquiring a customer to you? And what is the lifetime value you can expect from a customer? So a lot of that is being built on the back end where we get ready. So that's a long-winded way of saying we're expecting strong sales, maybe not as strong as previous years, but definitely better than 2021. And we are trying to smartly invest our brands advertising dollars while at the same time trying to save them as much money and optimize the listing for those least expensive activities like organic purchases, which is everyone's favorite.
So you said so many things. I'm going to dig into each and every one of those. But I want to just bring focus to something you said. I don't know if you had that in mind, but I found it very significant. So I heard you mention that e-commerce has 15% of the total retail market.
That's correct.
In other words, $100 that's spent in retail, $15 is spent online.
Yep, nailed it.
I remember in 2013, that's 9 years ago, doing a presentation. And in that presentation, that percentage was 5%.
Wow.
So online retail was only 5% of the whole retail. Now, let's call it 10 years. It's actually not 9 years, it's 8 years. So in 8 years, it grew. It
three
tripled.
Times. Yeah.
And it's still at 15%. It's still at 15%.
What do you think it's going to look like when it's at 50%? And I'm curious, do you think we'll see that in our lifetime?
Yeah, I think we will. But you know what this is going to be? Remember the old cartoon Jetsons family?
Yeah, the Jetsons, yes.
Yeah, flew around in cars and everything. Yeah. Or even better, Back to the Future 3, where he had the hoverboard. Yeah. And it was, what year was that? I don't remember.
It was like 2020. It's already passed. The hoverboard's not there yet.
Yeah, it's not there yet. So some of the things in Jetsons are already happening. And hoverboard didn't happen, even though it was supposed to happen 2 years ago. But if you look at the growth rate, but most important, if you look at people's lifestyles, how they are changing, how their behaviors, how they value their time. And you know, this is really the golden rule I try to live by. Money is not the most important thing in the world. You can make money, lose money, replace the money you lost, but time is the most important commodity. And as you get older, you realize that more. So you cannot replace time. So any time that you have to go to a store, look for stuff and buy it and come back home and blah, blah, realize, oh, you have to return it and take it back. All these things, they take time. So I think that people are becoming more time sensitive. So therefore, that's going to fuel the growth of online retail. It will increase its share. In addition, there are products coming out that support that kind of lifestyle. That's another. Retail experience is in transformation. Nobody really knows what retail is going to look like 10 years from now.
Oh, no way.
Chances are they will just be showrooms, and then you will go to order, you know, on the nearest terminal in the store. So I think that this is going to grow. So recession, frankly, I don't think that I don't see Amazon sellers or online companies or companies that have created an online operation will participate in recession. That's what I
100% agree. And they won't have a choice. You'll either be doing this or you won't be in business anymore.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. This is the new way. And then people have to jump on board. Okay. So now let's move on to the rest of the stuff that you mentioned. So what I heard really, we're talking about private label sellers. We're not talking about online arbitrage. So
yeah, yes.
For private label sellers, their greatest asset is the listing, right? That's what it is. So tell us, how do you measure the success of a listing?
It'll vary based on the maturity of the product. So we like to tell people there's really only two methodologies. We're in growth mode, and you've raised our efficiency so we can operate at a little more of a loss with the goal of earning BSR around very relevant keyword terms and ranking better for root keywords that have long-term value. And that's, you know, there's cycles for that. I think every business does it, whether you sell products or you sell services. The other aspect is profitability. So, you know, how do we operate your business? How do we advertise more efficiently? And those are the two kind of means of operation. So, you know, when we're setting goals with brands that we work with, a lot of it comes down to like, where do we want to be this year? Are we looking for 15%, 20% year over year growth? Let's reverse engineer what that looks like and what it's going to cost you to see if you guys have the type of budgets and margins to support this type. And then the other side of that is, you know, hey, we're tight on margins. We want to make more money from our marketplaces so we can support other initiatives. Like TikTok is huge. A lot of our brands are experimenting with TikTok. The next Amazon, we'll see. I'm sure there was a next Facebook too, and Meta, it's still around. So those are kind of where the conversation starts. So that's why I say it depends. But super high level for your listeners, if we're in a profitability mindset, it's how can we be more efficient. So a lot of things we'll look at is like dimension and weights. Before and after major events to make sure that we are being charged properly. Amazon will change stuff. They will put your products into their machine and they'll just measure it. But if you sell like something in a poly bag that might puff up a little bit based on whatever the content is, but it folds flat, this is like common in apparel, they'll keep bumping you up to that next charge. And it could be like $1.25 a unit, depending on what that size is. So having somebody from the team go on and do a bin check, you know, are ways you could save money. Are products being checked in? Are they being damaged? Checking returns if you have that ability. So like these are things we'll put in place to make you more money efficiently. And on the advertising side of things, it's obviously like, what is our advertising cost of sale? Eliminating campaigns that are, you know, mid to upper funnel that might not be driving as many direct sales. They may be for more awareness, but depending on what our KPIs are, we'll take away from those campaigns and then focus more on that bottom of the funnel. So people exposed to your brand and people in market for your products. So those are, you know, generally how we look at profitability. And if we're in growth mindset, it's the same concept, but it's expanding. So we'll still want to make sure we're operating efficiently. Where the inefficiencies come in, it's like, what promotional strategy are we putting in place? Are we going to do BOGOs, percent offs, coupons, and then the advertising side? How much margin are you going to give me to go mid to upper funnel? So where, how are you going to allow me to build audiences for you? And a lot of, like, we track cost per acquisition. We track capturing shoppers at the three phases. We just do bottom, mid, top, BOFO, MOFO, TOFO, internal acronyms, but top of funnel, middle of funnel, bottom of the funnel. And then if you can give your, if you can measure it, but for, if you're an agency owner and you can measure that for your clients, they get a lot of value in that. So they know as they're working with their agency partner, it manages expectations. If you're like, hey, my cost per acquisition is $12 and other retail channels is $10. How can we get this down? Okay, that's profitability. Let's go solve that problem. So as we're prepping for Q4, we're going to look at our brands that we manage underneath those two lenses and make strategic decisions based on the outcomes that they want for the end of the year.
So, okay, let's define those, your internal acronyms, but yeah, conceptually, what is the top of the funnel?
Top of the funnel is somebody in discovery who's based more on demographic. So like, we'll get this information from usually DSP, but we'll, a programmatic demand side platform. But what we'll get is information like your typical shopper, and it's available through brand analytics too, but they're typically between the ages of 25 and 35. They have a discretionary income of blank. Their interests are, you know, books, these types of movies, and this information. And then what we're doing is we're building overlap audiences from existing and affinity audiences through DSP, build these audiences, pepper them with ads, and try to get them to engage. It's not about sales at the top of funnel. It's about discovery of my brand, getting them to look at my product or storefront page. And if you're running it on DSP, we can send them to your website. We can send them to informational pages. Generally, the more expensive your item is, the more education that's required. So you're not generally, you know, if somebody's looking to make a mattress purchase, you don't want to drive them on a top of funnel campaign directly to your page to make a purchase. You want to drive them to something that's going to inform them on why your product is more superior than the competition. So you just have to be strategic when you're thinking of top of funnel discovery. How do I get my brand?
So on Amazon, I heard you mention send it to website, but you're not sending them to the website. So on Amazon, this top of the funnel, where do they go to see your
product? I'm talking about programmatic. You can drive to the website using Amazon's data. So these are Amazon audiences with Amazon shopping behavior that we're using demand side platform tactics to build your audience. They are targeted on, we could drive them to your website, and we're also targeting these shoppers on and off Amazon on their mobile and smart devices, as well as on their desktop. That's, we mainly use that for top of the funnel. Technically, if we're talking on platform, your SEO, your backend search terms, you can kind of advertise for keywords that are complementary, but you can only get so high. And then the display feature in the advertising console are really the only tools we have outside, unless you're working with Amazon Live influencers. So those would be like the three components that can drive, and two of those components, Amazon Live and the listing aspect, is what you could drive directly on Amazon. DSP and demand side platform, you have to work with a certified agency or with Amazon directly. So that's the only way you'd be able to build those audiences and get those features.
Okay, so this is just basically your demographics, your basic demographics that you are targeting, and then you're creating awareness for those people. So primarily, you are creating impressions at this point. There's no
impressions. But keep in mind the value of impressions. Google, for example, social, Facebook, Meta, whatever you call it. Amazon is based on actual shopping data. The third-party advertising cookie that Apple and Google devices have took away are not really as impactful for Amazon because they have, what, 80 million Prime members across the country in the U.S. alone. So, like, their ability to deliver very relevant ads to an audience that's very engaged is far superior than Google, which is based on search behavior and browser history, and Meta slash any other social media might be advertising, which is based on engagement. All of these can tell and build your audiences, but Amazon has shopping data. And if you are in e-commerce, it is the Mecca.
Yeah. So these ads are running on Amazon.
On and off of Amazon, owned and operated parties, as well as third-party suppliers, like, you know, your ad roll and anywhere else where you could buy programmatic ads. It's completely run through Amazon. It's in Amazon's advertising console. But like I said, only agencies and really big brands, as well as Amazon, have seats on here. So, like, common use for DSP is, like, if you are selling on Amazon and you have hit like $1.2 million, you're doing like $100,000 a month, and you're like, I can't do anything to get sales up on Amazon. What should I do? You're missing this piece. Your PPC and your bottom of the funnel is being eaten up by competition, because we know like 3,700 new sellers join a day on Amazon. And so DSP, there's a barrier to entry because you have to work with an agency and or Amazon. And generally, it'll give us the ability to keep the top of the funnel fueled so we can make sure we have a healthy bottom of the funnel to help the brand scale and kind of build on that year over year. So, I mean, anybody who's advertising and marketing kind of gets it, but this is how it works with Amazon, and this is how we use it as an agency.
Okay. So this DSP is really only for growing companies that have gone beyond 100,000 or want to go beyond 100,000 a month.
It varies. Yeah. I mean, typically that's where the stagnation we find. So you could pull your Amazon business up, you know, and there's some like rare ones out there that don't advertise at all. Realistically, like if you're $500,000 a month, you're doing like 30 to 50K. It's a good idea to turn it on and do the bottom of the funnel. So, like, you know, retarget, build that lifetime value, get people in market, exposed to your brand who didn't make a purchase 7, 14, 30 days. And also who went to a competitor's page, viewed the product, but didn't make a purchase. So, like, kind of scavenge those customers. So, like, that's something I would start pretty early on, like, as long as you're getting enough impressions, and that's for your judgment. But generally, like, brands that can afford it, especially if they're Amazon only, they should be doing, like, at least 50K a month, $500,000 a year, where it kind of makes sense to maybe bite the bullet and take on something, because it is more expensive, and you are, at the end of the day, it won't perform as well as traditional pay-per-click, because it's just, it's an impression-based system. It's not geared directly towards ROAS.
Okay. And then you said the middle of the funnel. So define the middle of the funnel and what to do with it.
So generally, like when because I like to group them together, basically middle of the funnel I consider is customers who are shopping in adjacent categories. So if I sell toothpaste, they might be shopping for toothbrushes. Competitors, I consider your conquesting strategy to be in market or mid funnel. So people who have or have not been exposed to your brand, but they're actively shopping for your product. So they're looking for this specific toothpaste and they're looking to sell, you know, they're looking to buy it. And then the kind of the tier below that, would be trying to think, would be, we have your in market, we have your conquesting, and I guess that would cover most of it, because the bottom, it's affinity audiences. So the third metric of in market is creating affinity audiences. So we'll be able to, it could be your website, it could be email list. Traditionally, we use this to build audiences on specific products or competitor products, and then duplicate those audiences with lookalike audiences or affinity audiences. And we consider that mid-market. And that's our ability to target these customers who have shown intent, and it should drive a better ROAS. We may not be able to directly attribute it to DSP, but we'll be able to tie it to total sales, which is why we like to use tacos.
And the bottom of the funnel.
Bottom of the funnel is all branded and lifetime value. So somebody who's been exposed to your brand, historical shoppers, and Amazon, if we're talking about the DSP specifically, allows us to retarget shoppers up to a year. And then, you know, some other mechanisms on the platform is the post-purchase email sequence is a touch point that's low cost that I would consider as part of that retention. If you sell product, that's like a one-time purchase, making sure you're linking to your warranty information and you're complying to all Amazon. So you're like, you're not sending them to your website. You're sending them somewhere legitimate where you can keep them in your funnel. I think would be the big one, the brand exposed to your brand, and you can touch them through advertising the other bottom of the funnel would be good organic listings, making sure that your brand name is in your title where appropriate. This way your products are ranking better for your search terms. So kind of a defensive strategy, which could be tied to advertising, but as well as organically. You could consider also like virtual bundles if something's typically bought together and it showcases on the actual listing in a section that's like, they're getting better with the graphics, but these are a bunch of bundles. So it takes away real estate and then it gives your shoppers more options to come back to buy from you again.
So how are you able to track these? So for each one of these, so what is the ultimate measure? So for your bottom of the funnel, you mentioned lifetime customer value, right? So
yeah.
But we're talking strictly Amazon. So Amazon does not let you email the customers, solicit them, unless you're responding to their questions and things like that. So how do you measure? Because on every sale, you know, with the ultimate goal when you're selling through your website is you acquire the customer through advertising, and then you work them through your loyalty program, whatever the case may be, so that they keep coming back. And then you can then measure, okay, how many times did each customer come back and shop and how much they spent over X number of years. And then there you have your lifetime value. But that's not really possible on Amazon. So how do you measure the lifetime value of a customer on Amazon?
Great question. It is kind of measurable, I believe. So if you're working with an Amazon rep, generally we could see how many people make purchases in a given lifetime in a year, and then how that stacks up compared to your peers. So directly through Amazon, we're able to acquire that data. Most of the brands we work with have that. I believe on the back end through brand analytics, you can get a pulse on how much you're selling. What's the return? The repeat purchase rate versus your peers, and then the top 10% of your peers. So that information's in there. The email proponent of it. So a couple ways to do it. So like it's kind of measurable, but it's only measurable within a year increment. So however you want to capture that data, you can capture that data. But when we talk about best practices for like building lifetime value, we do have some touch points at Amazon. So the first thing you should be doing, Amazon posts. It's Instagram for Amazon. You can pretty much copy what you're doing on Instagram and just put those right on Amazon. There's no tool to schedule it. So I highly recommend hiring a virtual assistant and having them kind of scrape your Instagram and put those on. We do it 3 times a week and run up the holidays. We do it every day because it does work. But that also ties to what we find generally, if you're running posts, you're acquiring 2 to 7% followers, increase in followers to your brand store. So generally, you know, if you have 100 followers and we're doing posts 3 times a week, you're going to get, you know, 2 to 7 new followers a month, which it compounds the larger your brand is. If you have followers on your storefront, you can use the customer engagement tool, which is available to brands. It allows us to email customers who have opted in to follow your store with updates on new products, discounts, and a few other things. It's all templated. You have minimal customs. You could essentially add the products you want to feature, and sending emails out. We run those about weekly during busy seasons like now. We run them twice a month, any other time, and it's a great way to get additional sales and build lifetime value. The last piece, we don't use this as much, I'll be straight with you, but post-purchase email sequences used to be really effective. You're right, you can't capture their email addresses, and you have to be careful with the terms of service of the solicitations, but there are ways to ask for reviews within terms of service. There are ways to share warranty information and how to use this product. You do have to be careful with linking off your website, the language that you use. You can't say, give me a positive review, because that's a fast way to get your account suspended. So Amazon Help has a lot of great articles. So when you're in the Amazon console, top right, search information in there on the standards, facts. I love FAQs. You could find a lot of stuff for like proper communication with your customers. So that's how like the tools Amazon has given us to that helps it increase that lifetime value. And it's only getting better. So like they're adding more tools. So this was something a lot of people are having trouble with. They're tying in KPIs to lifetime value. So I do think over time, we're going to see more transparency and be able to measure this better and ideally have more engagement opportunities with our Amazon audiences.
It's true. They are releasing more data because it didn't used to be available. And I think there's been a shift. I'm still not clear on the lifetime value, not because of any other reason than I like to be specific. Yeah. If I'm going to track lifetime customer value, I'd like customer IDs. I want to be able to fetch. And that's not possible on Amazon.
That is not possible. Not that I'm aware of. They're giving us tools to touch it, but they're protecting that data. I'd imagine they pretty much always will. There's a lot of value in data.
I have a question for you. I don't know the answer to this. I have to check. This is easy to figure out, but I don't know. When somebody places an order, they mask the email.
Yeah.
Is it the same mask every time or does it alternate?
I'm not really sure, to be honest with you, just because like that's gray hat. We wouldn't go down that area. I do know through different user groups that I'm a part of that people break the rules. If there's rules, there's always people looking for loopholes. There are like email parser services that you can, from what I understand, is export that info, send it over to them, and somehow they're able to get all those email addresses, but highly illegal. We no way recommend it. I'm not sure how they're cloaking.
Yeah. What I was getting at was I'm not looking to get the email address, so to speak, but the email address, whether it's masked or not, that's an ID, right?
Yeah.
So you can simply say, okay, how many orders have I gotten and how many of them are repeating? Because our email addresses, most websites these days, your username is your email address. So in this case, it happens to be masked. You can't reach the customer, nor you would wanna, because that would violate the TOS. But that you could use that as your customer ID to measure your lifetime value. That's what I was getting at. So I wonder if...
I think it's possible. I think the data points Amazon gives you kind of makes it a little easier. Because even to your point, even if you figured out like this one customer with mask ID 2254 or something like that made three purchases, it still doesn't mean like, what can I do with that? Where, at least they're like, on average, you're getting two purchases a year from these customers, which could help offset some of your advertising expenses if you can... estimate how many repeat purchases you'll get.
Yeah. And the other thing is, if it's a website, you are spending so much in advertising and then ultimately it becomes organic. But there is no organic on Amazon in the sense that you're paying the 15% to Amazon every time.
Yeah.
And all doing. So really, what I'm seeing is there would be a great value if you could tell. The ratio between your paid traffic and organic traffic and how it changes company-wide as well as at SKU level. So do you have, because as you know, the more advertising that you do, the more organic clicks you get.
Yeah.
So do you know, have you discovered the relationship between the two yet?
Yes, because that's kind of what we do to like solve stagnant sales, which is a common like mid-sized business. We're able to pull the data from all the different platforms and segment it to get an idea of where, like we have a Google Data Studio report we created internally that has this different segmentation, where they're coming in on the funnel, on the SKU level or on the account wide, you know, whether it's categories within your catalog. And we're able to kind of measure like what's the cost position, cost per acquisition, your ROAS, your tacos, but also like detailed page views, add to carts, subscribe and save rate, you know, for somebody, you know, for as simple as adding an extra 5% to your subscribe and save could increase the rate of subscribe and save 20 to 30%. So like some of these components all kind of work together to help these brands scale, but it's very measurable. The transparency and data is there. It's kind of what you do with it. There are software solutions that do a really good job of this, like Perpetua, Amalytics, which is a German company. We also use Merchant Spring. So like we have a software suite that allows us to pull all this data to get SKU wide information, as long as we have all the cost data associated with it. So it comes out of how large your operation is, but the data can all be dumped in a spreadsheet. And if you're great with macros, you can report those pretty easily. But also there's some software solutions out there that are relatively inexpensive that you can use for reporting that can give you that granularity. The lifetime value are like Merchant Spring and Amalytics. They'll kind of measure components of that, but it's algorithm. It's more formulaic. So it's like they don't have that answer directly from Amazon, but based on the inputs we do have, they're able to reverse engineer that. So like there's some value there. And it's always like for us, the end of the year. So from, you know, August really until November, we talk a lot about budgets, market share, what it looks like to dominate specific categories, and being able to pull this information into our conversations allows us to be more accurate, but it helps manage expectations a lot better. I can't tell you how many people that come in, they're like, I want to double my sales and spend the same exact amount of money I spent before. And it's like, dude, it's a ratio. That's not how it works. Like all of this is just ratios with diminishing returns. But, you know, c'est la vie, such is life, right?
The favorite metric I'd like to track company-wide and also at SKU level, of course, there are many events surrounding it, but is the conversion rate.
Yeah.
So how do you track conversion rate?
Through the dashboard and through the different software solutions we use. We split test monthly. So we comes down to like what's most important to you, but generally we take the top selling products and we split test. We used to use like CellZone and some of the other softwares out there that would allow us to do split testing, but they've done so many updates to manage my experiments for Seller Central. If your Vendor Central accounts, you have to use a software solution, but for seller accounts, manage my experiments have everything. So kind of run our experiments directly through there. And then we report that information every 30 days, generally 30 to 45 days to allow for attribution. And then we'll make decisions based on the performance and we'll retest things, but we're always testing the images and we're always testing titles because titles get you quick through rate for relevancy. And then ideally you have, to your point, conversion rates are everything. So ideally you have really compelling bullets, really top-notch A-plus content, and that's going to help just naturally lift that conversion rate. And then the formula is like, how many more people can I drop in at this point of the shopping journey to turn that into sales? What will that cost me? And then you could kind of reverse engineer budgets, 90-day goals and KPIs, annual KPIs. It's all about being good at math and spreadsheets, apparently.
Yeah, you know, I heard you mention the word reverse engineer or the phrase reverse engineer several times. So I guess that's the only way, really. I mean, it's the only way in life because Imagine where you want to be, reverse engineer that to where you are today, right?
Amen to that. Amen to that. I was actually, I have a little bit of an engineering background too. So like some of this comes naturally to me. Nick, I think you have an engineering background too. Is that a correct statement? Didn't you do, do software?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. When I got my engineering degree, those days computers were just being invented. So my faculty my degree was electronics, communications, and computers. And if you got this degree, you could build a chip, how to actually manufacture a chip. You could learn how to build a dam and a nuclear energy plant, and you could write program, code, learn how to code and learn data. So I ended up, it was very intense, but I enjoyed it. It teaches you. I was talking to somebody earlier. Yeah, if my parents told me this, my life would have been totally different. College is about two things, and neither one of them is about learning a certain profession. Number one, it's about creating your network of people that you can keep going back to. So figure out, what kind of a community, because every college provides a different kind of network.
Oh, yeah. Your network is your net worth, as they say.
That's exactly it. The second thing is the college teaches you how to learn stuff. Mm-hmm. It doesn't teach you anything because, it conditions you to learn stuff in a methodical way. That's all it does.
And hit it on the head. Spoken like a true engineer too, because it's very methodical. But I think you hit it. You make great points too. Is when you graduate, you just indirectly, you're just doing this all the time, and it
becomes
a beautiful thing.
So this is a good segue, talking about college days to you. So let's now get to know you a little bit. Tell us, where did you grow up?
Oh, I grew up in Long Island, New York. I like to tell people I'm an Islander. I grew up in specifically Seaford is where I spent most of my time. I'm a Nassau County kid. New York for me was the best place to grow up in the 90s. We did a lot of not as much technology and a lot of Jones Beach and hanging out over there, as well as stickball in the schoolyard and all that fun stuff.
So how was this interest? How did it develop into numbers? Is it your, as a kid, were you entrepreneurial?
Indirectly. So my dad ran an elevator business where he installed and maintained elevators for 45 years in New York City in the belly of the beast. And I got a lot, as somebody who actually did the service and understood the art, but also had to do the marketing and sales and all the other stuff that came with it. He just had incredible work ethic. And I think I took a lot of that. We're also a military family. So I did 5 years, three out of my four brothers served. My dad and his brother served, my grandfather and his brother served, their grandfather served. So we come from a family of just military. I joined the Navy. I would say I wasn't as entrepreneurial, but I got a lot of really basic skills on like discipline, being organized. I used to hate writing standard operating procedures, and I still write them to this day. So I've been writing them at this point, for 20 years, which is crazy. But then how did I get into e-commerce? Because I served in the Navy, Connecticut and Texas are one of two states that have something called the Yellow Ribbon Program for their veterans. And because of that, I got in a top 50 business school, Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut. I'm the second family member. My one brother who didn't join the service beat me. He got his college degree before I did. A number two. And what that did, I was in the Navy. I'm a licensed electrician. I learned a lot about power plants. And when I got out of the service, I got a job as a maintenance person. And then I worked my way up in the power industry to a manager while going to school full time. but it gave me the opportunity. So when I graduated from Quinnipiac, I pretty much left a very comfortable six-figure job to go make $10 an hour at a startup doing marketing. And I never looked back. I got into Google Ads, which led me into Amazon Ads. And then I, you know, we started flipping products on our own. And then we started consulting. And then I got jobs at other agencies and built up my experience working on Amazon and Walmart. And then in 2018, probably like a lot of great entrepreneurs, I was like, I can do this better myself and I'm tired of it. So we started Bellavix in 2018. And I've been doing nothing but Amazon and Walmart since. And that's the dream, right?
So I can see that having the work ethics and the discipline and staying focused, that's your dad, that's how he brought you up, and then the military, because that's all about discipline, right? So
all about
so those are perfect for running an Amazon operation. And and by the way, I can see you are in the certified provider network. So you're going strictly by the book. So that's not just because it's not a gimmick. It's not a marketing approach. It's in your DNA to come with that discipline approach. Okay, so what is the most disciplined environment? It's the certified, to be certified provider. But what I want to understand is where does the, I understand your dad ran his business, but this entrepreneurial approach, where do you think that came from? What is drawing you into the unknown?
I mean, honestly, financial independence. It has been a big part of influencing, and then coming from a very hierarchical driven career path, you know, the Navy, it's very much like time and rate, do your thing. Then in the power industry is a lot of the same thing. And I kept getting passed up for promotions because I did really great work, but I just didn't have enough time in, and they didn't want to offend somebody who was older and put more time in. And when you, if you ever read Seth Godin's book, Lynchpin, I consider myself a linchpin. So you could only dissuade me so much. And that led me into being like, I could do it better, and this is how I could do it better, and this is why we do things this way. So I don't know how exactly I fell into entrepreneurship at this point, but I could not see me doing like anything else, because I just get such enjoyment from having the control. So maybe I'm a bit of a control freak now. This is like a little therapy for me too, Nick. I'm happy we're doing this.
I have a theory.
Let me hear it.
You know the movie Network? I think it's called The Network. He opens the windows and says, I'm not going to take this anymore. Remember that? I think that the reason why you started your own operation is, first of all, you know yourself through the years, having that disciplined approach to things and getting things done. And then as yet, kept getting passed on. And then you said, that's it, I'm done. I'm not having this anymore. Nobody's going to pass me on anymore. I'm going to run my own show. So I think this was like a revolt against, you know, everybody and every company you work for, and just to show them that this is it. Nobody is doing this to you anymore.
Right on, Dr. Nick. I think we just made a breakthrough.
Do you think that was part of your...
No, I think that's exactly it. I agree with that. A lot of it too was just like, I am in control of my own destiny, and this is how we're doing it. And we're 4 years in. We've had some scares as any new business owner, but it's fun. I recommend anybody who's interested.
You are an entrepreneur. I'm gonna end with a funny story. So I belong to an organization called Entrepreneurs Organization.
Great organization.
Yeah, you know about it.
So
one day we were at an event, and you know, New York chapter is the largest usually. So 200 plus of us. So we were at an event, major event, and it's a lot of people, and it was also a joint event. They had another group. So it's a long line. And then there's like people running around saying, stand here, stand here, stand here. Nobody's standing in the line. Nobody's following instructions. So one of my friends standing right in front of me, you know, once this woman walks past and giving instructions, telling people what to do, he turns around to me and says, doesn't she know? We are entrepreneurs. We don't like to be told what to do. That's why we are here.
I'm in good company.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So it's a different breed. So thank you. Well, this was great. I mean, you were like, you unleashed. We could spend hours unpacking.
We usually really could.
People say a few things and then I unpack them and I don't leave anything untouched. In your case, I was able to unpack maybe 15% of everything you said. But people can reach out to you. And so give us your contact information. How can people reach you?
Definitely. I'd say check out our website, www.bellavix.com. You can talk to Michelle. She's in charge of our chat, or email us directly at hello@bellavix.com. We have a regular newsletter that goes out weekly and monthly on the latest trends on Amazon and marketplaces, and then news and updates. So if you're trying to get the pulse on Amazon and e-commerce, definitely check it out. As well as check me out on LinkedIn, Will Hare. I post something every day, a couple times a day, about Amazon and marketplaces. So like to share a lot of information with our audience, and happy to be here, Nick. Anytime you want me back, I'm happy to jump on a call and we, like I said, we could do this for hours. So maybe we'll have a fireside talk. And do it with some wine.
It's a great conversation. We'll continue the therapy. All right. Well, and thank you for your service and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Nick. Appreciate it. And thanks, guys, for listening.
And this brings us to the end of another episode, and I'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. Be sure and subscribe, rate, and review our show. And be sure and share an episode with a friend. And thank you so much for being with us today. We'll see you next week here on Amazon Legends.